The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Day two of our late summer vacation. The last days off, except for Labor Day and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, before, well, not just the big election in November, but also the 10-year anniversary of the show. And we have a great interview for you today. It's with Jeff Charlotte. He's the author of The Family. You may have seen that documentary on Netflix. Journalist, contributing editor, Harper's Magazine. Writing in Vanity Fair, Inside the Cult of Trump. And to many extent... well, I mean, we'll talk to Jeff Charlotte about it, but we are really talking about something that's super cultish. I mean, it has morphed into, an iteration of it is QAnon. But it is pretty stunning at this point where you have a situation where, you know, the people can argue... I mean, not I don't think effectively, but people can argue that Donald Trump was scratching some type of itch and that there are a lot of people out there who feel like they don't have anything to lose. And so they were going to, you know, screw it. Why not? Let's put the clown in there and see what happens. It'll shake stuff up. But you got to be pretty cynical to believe that government is not equipped in any way to deal with a pandemic, right? I mean, if you don't think a government is suited to deal with a pandemic, then I don't think that you believe that there should be a government. Would, you know, some people are like that. But, and, you know, but in terms of like basic functions of a government, right? Dealing with a nationwide problem that everyone is vulnerable to. Of course, those who are with the least economic power and the least political power are going to be more subject to it, like just about everything. In every instance where there is some phenomenon that is impacting people, it's always going to impact the most vulnerable the most. And the most vulnerable in this instance, you know, are people who are, you know, maybe living in poverty or living in less wealthy areas with the cuts in the hospitals, maybe rural areas, maybe urban areas. But you would imagine that people are like, yeah, no, government should at the very least address a pandemic. And there really is, I mean, this is one of those situations where even like Fox couldn't cover up the fact that the president reacted poorly to it because they did too. And they were in lockstep with him. We're going to pretend this isn't real. We're going to pretend you don't have to do anything about it. We're going to pretend like at first we're going to just sell the idea that like, look, the olds are just going to have to die. I mean, they're going to have to just suck it up and take one for the team so that their kids can go to a bar. We had Republican officials saying that at the beginning of this. Not even at the beginning. I mean, through, like, I don't know. Well, I guess it's all the beginning, but. And it seems to me to be impossible to ignore that reality. Now, maybe it is to a certain extent, but you really got to be paying no attention, or you really got to be basically refusing to step even a half an inch outside your bubble. And I say this as someone who I feel like I live in a bubble too, but you got to look around and think like, hey, wait a second, 2 + 2 is not adding up. Maybe there's something wrong in this scenario here. Anyways, so Jeff Charlotte has written, he did a lot of reporting on this, and he went back to check out, you know, some of the people that he initially reported on. Fascinating stuff. He's a great writer, and it's a very good interview. Just a reminder, I know the RNC is on. It's happening tonight, happened last night. I am recording this in the past, but even though the RNC has not actually happened when I record this, I feel very confident in saying, man, that was bat crap crazy. Seriously? What the hell was that? Or that other thing? Well, if you tune in to the Nomiki show today, you can find it at patreon.com, The Nomiki Show, or youtube.com, The Nomiki Show. And you can watch her recap. She's had great panelists, great guests talking about this stuff. And I may jump on, you know, do some live streaming. Like I say, pick up the app at majorityapp.com. It's free, iOS or Android. And we will send out a notice that I'm going to jump on. To talk about stuff. If I do, it's really just a function of, you know, how much I can get away from my kid for, usually that's not very long. I usually cannot get away from my kid for more than, like, I don't know, 60 seconds at a time. But, you know, it's vacation. The kid wants some dad time. So I give him a little bit. I know you don't want to spoil him with it. So, folks, we've all searched for something online that we didn't want other people knowing about. I mean, come on. You know, I'm getting older. I'm looking at all sorts of like old man stuff that I'm looking at, you know, how to increase your virility. I guess I'm sort of channeling Michael here. This is where he would say like, I'm looking for low T stuff or something. But no, there's always stuff that you've searched online. I don't know. There's always stuff that you're looking at that you just don't want, that you want a certain amount of privacy. I don't know. You're checking on things that you might want to purchase. You're checking on, like, you're looking up or, you know, I don't know. There's a whole host of those things. Unfortunately, incognito mode on your browser, it doesn't hide your activity. Doesn't matter how many times you clear your browsing history, your internet service provider can still see every website you've ever visited. We are losing our ability to remain private more and more every single day. So even when you're at home, you don't go online without using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP cannot see the sites that you visit. ExpressVPN keeps all your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. It runs seamlessly in the background. It's easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button. Boom, you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices. You can have it on your phone, your computers, even your smart TV. So protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. You can visit my exclusive link. It's expressvpn.com/majority. You can get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. Look, you want to make sure that you keep what you're doing online private. Why? There are scenarios that in many respects, we can't even imagine right now. That's express, ExpressVPN.com/majority. ExpressVPN.com/majority to learn more. We will put that link in our podcast description and our YouTube description. Now we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Charlotte, journalist, contributing editor, Harper's, author of The Family, writing in Vanity Fair, Inside the Cult of Trump. Be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program after many, many years, Vanity Fair contributor, professor at Dartmouth University, author of his latest, This Brilliant Darkness, Jeff Charlotte, on a piece that I read, Jeff, in Vanity Fair, Inside the Cult of Trump, His Rallies Are Church, and He is the Gospel. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be with you.
I had sort of alluded to this briefly before we started, and we're recording this Thursday, the beginning of July. And I have to say, you know, I read it when the piece came out, which was about, I guess, 2 weeks ago now. And I reread it this morning, and it is combined with the alert I just got on my phone that Florida is over 10,000 cases today. And these are people who were infected probably when your piece came out a couple of weeks ago. And having spoken to an expert on fascist lies yesterday. I have to say the piece is both sort of funny, but also incredibly dark. And so just give us a sense of how many Trump rallies did you attend over the course of or have you attended, period, but in the course of writing the story?
This one really sort of built out of about six rallies, and really there was three rallies that I attended that are the mainstay of this story in Bossier City, Louisiana, right outside of Shreveport, Hershey, Pennsylvania, the so-called sweetest place on earth, and Sunrise, Florida, which is in the heart of Broward County, very deep blue Broward County. But I was also drawing from reporting I did in 2016 for New York Times Magazine, where I again traveled the country looking at the role religion played in these rallies. So when I went this time looking to see what's happened in 2020, I was comparing with what I had seen in 2016. And you say it's dark, and that's what I came away with. 2016, I came away with, this is dark. This was in early 2016, and I came back sort of saying, hey, everybody, wake up. This guy is real. This is very scary. And I thought I knew what I was going to see this time, and instead, it stunned me. I wasn't prepared. My time away from the rally trail, and frankly, the press coverage of it had not prepared me for what a darker turn these rallies have taken in the years in between.
Okay. And I want to get to, you know, what the darker aspect of it, but I want to start with this because all the people you do speak to in the, in this piece and you frame it, His Rallies Are Church and He is the Gospel. And you, you obviously are coming from, you know, your first questions, your first assumptions, basically where you're coming from is looking at these things from a perspective of religion. I mean, I think one of the first interviews that I probably did with you was about the family, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, which I should say still haunts me. And I think it's still extremely relevant. People should pick up that book because it's sort of shocking how many of our politicians have been involved in that. But so how much, so with that said, right, and from my religious studies time in undergraduate, my professor always taught me to get that primary assumption as people are looking at these things. So you're going in, you're looking for the religiosity in these rallies. How much would you say is there relative to the rest of it? I mean, are we talking, you know, I don't know if you want to say it as a percentage wise or what, but like, give me a qualitative, I should say a quantitative sort of perspective on how dominant the folks that you cover in this are within the context of, at the very least, I guess, the Trump rally movement or sector, I guess.
Well, the way I describe it is I'd say that the rally itself is essentially not even a political event. It's a religious ritual. It's the means by which Trump sort of transforms this idea of the American dream into a revenge fantasy. And within that, you have people participating coming from different religious streams. I was interested in what percentage of people that I would meet believed in this idea of Trump as the chosen one, you know, this idea of him as a religious figure. And that's something, actually, you mentioned the family. I actually did an update to that in 2019 in Netflix. We released a 5-part documentary series called The Family and Bringing It Up into the Trump Years and the Christian Rights Embrace of Trump. And what I found and sort of surprised me was, I don't know, I probably spoke to about 100 people at these three different rallies. I mean, all but a few had some variation of Trump as God anointed, God selected. They might think he's pious. They might think he's not. They might be church-going people or they might not. But it all came back to this idea of that what is going on with Trumpism is bigger than politics. It is a religious movement. And that's reflected back at them from the stage. Well, what Trump is doing is performing a kind of religious revival meeting, much more so than politics. The policies, the issues and so on, that doesn't matter. That's not what anyone is there for. They're there for what they experience as ecstasy and what anyone looking from the outside sees as a sort of an ecstasy of hate and of the righteousness of revenge.
And I should say, when you say they're referring to him as the chosen one, you're not, these are not, you're not even saying that they refer to him in language that is analogous to the chosen one, right? It's all a variation of that. Like, you know, there people aren't saying he's my man. He's, you know, he's the guy.
No. He's right. The best. No. People sort of saying, I would ask. I'd say, I think, it's a minority, but it's not an insignificant minority who will say that he is divine himself. But others will say, he was chosen by God. And that's where you see the divide. Some think, obviously he's a God-filled man, a God-shaped man, as Lance Wallnau, an evangelical advisor to Trump, puts it in a best-selling book called The Chaos, God's Chaos Candidate. And they recognize that. Wallnau calls him a wrecking ball. No one thinks that he is this, you know, Ned Flanders character, but some see that as evidence that God is using him. If someone like this, such an uncouth man with no basis in politics, thrice married, as they like to say, if someone like this can assume that office, obviously God's hand must be behind it. And then comes QAnon, the vast sort of network of conspiracy theories, that forms a kind of core theology of Trumpism. Not every Trump follower knows what QAnon is, but the ideas of QAnon, which sort of build around a kind of fundamentally religious premise that Trump is leading what they call a great awakening, which is a term from American religious history, the great awakening, that animates everything. So you can talk to people, say, I've never heard of Q, and then they can recite for you kind of scripture and verse from the QAnon conspiracy worldview, and they get it again reflected back from Trump on the stage.
Okay, now this is where we gotta unpack this a little bit, because this is the update on some level, right? I mean, there was no QAnon in 2016 as you're covering these rallies. This is, I guess, the is it the theology that has sort of like filled this vacuum that provided? So is that the part that was like really the most shocking to you, is that you come back and all of a sudden there's this whole, it's almost like they found like another Bible on some level, and they've all been going to these like new Bible sessions, and you come back and all of a sudden they're incredibly well versed on this thing that is, I mean, I'm going to, tip my bias here. I think it's all made up. But, uh, But
yeah, I don't think Hillary Clinton is leading a child trafficking ring, and I don't think JFK Jr. is actually plotting with Trump to bring her to justice. And I don't think he's going to be vice presidential candidate in 2020. All core QAnon beliefs. I'm pretty sure these are not true.
Well, but you at least you've revealed your bias.
That's a really good phrase.
You've revealed your bias, Jeff. There it is. People now, at least you've been honest about it, being skeptical about the Kennedy thing, because he would have probably done that before then. But all right, so yeah, I mean, so where, like, and you had no notion that this was coming up. Like, where does this, how does this integrate into the religiosity? Because you know, I find it fascinating how this thing has grown and has been like subsumed. And like, what do these people's pastors say when, I mean, presumably like they go to their church and they talk to their pastor and they mention QAnon. Does their pastors say like, well, wait a second. Yeah, that's not what we're doing here.
Yeah, in fact, the very second person I met at one of these rallies down in Louisiana, a man named Yusuf Jones, a white Christian man, burdened, as he put it, by an Islamic name by his hippie mother. He hated the name Yusuf, and he made up for it. He's a big guy. He's wearing a Trump mask. He's very, very amped up. And after talking to him and some other supporters in the parking lot for a while, he reveals that he's sort of a minor celebrity and that he was arrested for threatening to shoot up a Washington, D.C. pizzeria, not Comet Ping Pong, which is the pizzeria that was sort of at the source of the QAnon conspiracy theories. It's a popular pizzeria in Washington. It showed up in WikiLeaks because Democratic strategists like to meet there. These right-wingers couldn't believe that they were there just for the pizza. They must be there for the child trafficking.
And, right. This was a big Cernovich thing. Yeah. I think members of this audience are very familiar with Cernovich and Pizzagate. But so this is a...
And the man who acted on it by taking his assault rifle and opening fire. So Yusuf Jones thought this was so great. And he called up and he made his threat. He very quickly got busted. And then he wanted to, of course, he didn't want to go to prison, but he pled guilty. He now says, well, I didn't really do it. I just pled guilty. But because my pastor said it was a good thing if I had done it, it would have been a good thing because they're trafficking children. And you see, this is sort of, I didn't catch a show yesterday, unfortunately, but when you talk about the fascist lie, if you proceed from the premise that the enemy is perpetrating the worst crimes, child trafficking, and even worse than that in their imagination, then anything is justified. And that what becomes horrific, threatening to shoot people, becomes righteous. And I mean, I ended up encountering a lot of pastors at these rallies and encountering this view over and over. And that's what's changed. 2016, what you saw was called the prosperity gospel, country cousin to evangelicalism. It's what you see late night televangelism. Send me $100 and God will bless you and look at my private jet and that's why you know God loves me. That was what Trump was using in 2016. He's promising a lot of winning. And the years in between, his followers, they say, well, we won. Now what? Now we protect from these secret enemies within. And they see secret enemies everywhere. And I mean, anyone who's paying attention to Trump knows that he's obsessed with this idea of his long enemies list. But that's also a classic move of authoritarianism. Once you've stormed the gates, once you've got power, how do you hold on to it? You have to identify a threat. The threat has to be within. It has to be invisible. It has to be secret so that your followers will be on alert at all times and trust nobody but you.
Jeff, I mean, do you have a sense, and you know, I think this program in some respects is oriented towards, the material basis for you know, political actions and whatnot. I mean, do you have a sense of like What else is going on in these people's lives? Is it across the board? Are these people who are, and maybe this is also even a broader question as to, you know, what leaves people open to this type of religious experience or attracts them to this type of religion. What's going on that this becomes a thing for them? I mean, are we talking about people who have been are coming from communities that are have been, you know, decimated over the past couple of decades? Are we talking about people who are just, I mean, what tends to be the driver, it, to the extent that there is a consistent sort of through line in terms of how people came to this?
You know, they're coming from many different streams, and I think that's what we've always got to be aware of when we're looking at powerful social right-wing movements or any social movements, is what they represent as convergences. So Trump is bringing together, you know, in Bill Barr, we see the person of the kind of the conservative Catholic movement. We see the aristocratic elite evangelicals and the populist Christian right. I think of a figure, a person who becomes sort of the center of the story, a woman named Diane I met in Sunrise, Florida, in Broward County. And for her, and as was common, I have to say, I know people say it's a myth. I met a lot of people who really had been Obama voters. She had been a Democrat most of her life. And there was some personal crises in her life that overlapped with her sort of turn toward Trumpism. But also, and I thought this was really interesting, she was disillusioned with some aspects of the establishment Democratic Party. She was a religious person. She worked a lot with kids, very poor children in Haiti. And some people may know the Clintons have been very active in Haiti over the years. And this is not our imagination. They screwed it up.
Yep.
This Bill Clinton says, we screwed it up. They did a lot of damage. They tried to apply an American economic model. It didn't work. She saw that. She lacked any kind of structural critique. She couldn't explain in political and economic terms what had been done. So she turned to the terms of her church, spiritual war. And then along comes this movement saying, and not only did the Clintons, you know, do this horrible thing in Haiti, but they actually traffic children. And she can believe that. And it goes further as she turns to me and she says, they eat them. It's cannibalism. I thought this is so fringe. This is extreme. We're standing on the arena floor. I turn to the people around us, and they're from a range of backgrounds, economically, you know, religiously. And I say, do you believe this? I expect them all to say, she's crazy. No, some do, some don't. Some say, I don't know about cannibalism. I think that's maybe, I don't think they go that far. But child trafficking, sure. And you see, you know, the Overton window, as they put it, has been expanded so that that's within the realm of the possible. I think, though, it is important to recognize that Trump was able to turn a frustration with the failures of all sorts of establishments into a kind of conspiracy sort of thinking, to look at what is incompetence and to see it as demonic intent. And the number one enemy, of course, and they show up for every rally so conveniently, is the press. And, you know, most of the press sits in a metal cage in the middle of the arena. I go in just as a member of the crowd. I wait in line for 7 hours and so on. I don't understand why reporters agree to be caged, but that's another story. But that's the biggest hate line of the rallies, when Trump turns and uses them like a prop and he says, look at those scum back there, those liars, those people who have been telling you, you know, lies. Does anyone believe them? And people turn and they give him the finger and they scream in the sort of orgiastic kind of rage of hate. This idea that they've been lied to for a long time. And that, once you've got that fake news premise, you're going to start pulling in people into this conspiracy theory from all different directions.
It's fascinating, and I mean, there's so many different sort of, like, I guess, threads to pull at this. You know, a couple years ago, I had interviewed someone who had done a history of mesmerism in this country, and which was fascinating, and it is so reminiscent of this. And Trump obviously was relevant in this, and that there was a dynamic of, and I think you allude to this in the piece, but a dynamic of people looking at the mesmerist. It was literally at one point a guy named Mesmer, I think it was, or I can't remember, but something to that effect. And knowing that he is a liar, but feeling like he is lying for us as opposed to us. Did you come across like that type of dynamic?
Yes, I think that's so well put. And I think that's the thing, you know, on the Vanity Fair website, there's a short follow-up to the feature on the Tulsa rally, you know, his first rally, which I think a lot of liberals were delighted with, and they looked at and they said only 6,000 people showed up. And that was good news. That was good news. Keep in mind, 7 million people watched it on TV, which is more than have watched a lot of his rallies. But they saw that, and that was the first speech they saw for a lot of them, and they said, oh, God, this guy's losing it. He's so incoherent. It's not incoherent. The more rallies you attend, you understand that there's a rhetoric there. It's a kind of a double signal moving back and forth between the official story and then looking up from the teleprompter, this sort of performance of intimacy. I'm going to tell you the real deal. I'm going to curse so that you know I'm being authentic and so on. And so he's sort of saying, this official story I'm telling, it's not even true. The whole thing is I'm letting you in on secrets. You got to pay attention to how often Trump says there's more than I can tell you, which goes straight to the QAnon mentality. And this sort of secrecy mentality is more than I can tell you. Or as he said in Tulsa, now on November 3rd, you know, you're going to elect me unless we do something stupid. And then and he doesn't finish the sentence. He just says, you know what to do. You know what to do. Right. And not so much that he's quite lying to you, but he's not telling the whole story. You have to fill it in. And that idea from mesmerism, and that's an idea that comes also from, it's an old religious revival idea. This has got to be, there's got to be a call and response. There's got to be a way for the crowd to participate in the making of meaning. And Trump, in his very ugly and violent way, gives them that.
How much does, I mean, so for instance, this week we saw Trump. Oh, and I want to talk about the tweets too. That is just absolutely fascinating. But in this idea of, I need to just organize this because I have a couple of questions here I want to unpack. But we'll get to the tweet of the white power tweet in a moment. But I want to just stay on that aspect of like, because he's always had this thing where he is reading from a teleprompter and then sort of like steps to the side and not maybe physically, but in the way that he's addressing to the audience and comments on his own speech in some way.
Yeah.
Like he's right. He's reading like, you know, we have a very big meeting scheduled. And then he sort of turns and goes, it's a big meeting. It's maybe the biggest meeting we've ever had. And like, when he does that, to me, it looks like a guy who's like, he's giving up the game, right? He's like saying like, I'm he's breaking the fourth wall in some way, but he's saying that like, I'm engaging in a pretense. And to me, that's sort of revealing, like he has no idea the words he's saying. But if what I'm hearing from you is that that's actually like, that makes his audience feel like he's taking him into the sort of the green room with him. And like you guys know, I got to perform this for the cameras. But in the meantime, here's my little thing that you and I are sharing intimately.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's what's so fascinating about it is it gives it, if you're looking for a sort of smooth speech, it gives it this image of incoherence, which I think a lot of liberals and lefties find reassuring. This guy is dumb. And this is the thing that I say from having covered all these rallies, it always upsets my fellow liberals and lefties, is Trump's one of the best orators I've ever seen. And people say, he's not an orator. An orator is one who speaks. No, an orator is one who knows how to use language to communicate powerfully with a crowd. It may not be my crowd, but it's a big crowd. And he does know how to use language. And that is a particular movement back and forth that comes out of the church between where you always have the official story, right? Which is scripture. And then you've also got the pastor bringing in his life experience, you know, one time. Often his life experience isn't quite right. It's maybe he's talking about his past as a sinner and so on. Trump's doing that same thing. And you saw it so clearly in that Tulsa rally where he comes out. He's obviously upset because the crowd is small, and he's sticking to the teleprompter. And I was hoping that he would, because he'll do that sometimes. When he's really upset, he just reads from the teleprompter and goes home like a sulking child. But then he looks up and he does a little imitation of a CNN reporter, and the crowd roars, and he never turns back from there. He moves back and forth. There's at one point he's going on in much too much boring detail about some negotiation. No one's paying attention. So he throws in, "Dumb son of a bitch." And the crowd roars. Who's the dumb son of a bitch? Doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, why they're a dumb son of a bitch doesn't matter. This guy is talking to us. He's telling the truth. That's the president of the United States using this straight talk, breaking away from the teleprompter, breaking away from the script that controls him, that controls us. And that's that double signal, that back and forth, going back and forth between the official story and here, come a little closer. I'll tell you the real deal.
So when he tweets out retweets that white power video the other day, where like somebody in a golf cart was responding to protesters and said white power, and I think that guy in the golf cart, I think he's probably okay with all the tenets of it. I don't know that he said white power before. I think he was sort of saying that as a way of just sort of, you know, tweaking people. But irrespective, Trump retweets it. I don't know if Trump heard it or didn't, but they didn't take it down for 3 hours. And I have little doubt in my mind that that was a conscious decision where they said, you got to take this down. He's like, screw that. Let's just leave it up for a couple hours to play with people. When he does something like that, his followers, like, they know that he's got to take it down, but that they're also getting the message that he left it up for a little bit, right? I mean, like, it doesn't go away when he takes it down. They don't see him as being weakened in any way. They just see it as, like, he is fighting against all of these forces and, Walter William, whatever that, he's just some type of martyr hero.
They see it as what it is, which is a wink. And especially if they're Trump followers, they are now well tuned in to the rhetorical style, which I think, again, is surprising to those who, you know, those who don't like Trump. That man is not funny. That man is awful. You go to a Trump rally and it alternates between just screaming with anger and laughter. He does a lot of comedy routines. He likes to imitate windmills. He does skits where he plays out both characters. It's grotesque. For instance, he plays out the characters of the two FBI agents who had an affair.
Yes. Yes, Peter, I love you. Yes, I've seen some of that.
Lisa Page coming, right. You know, having this orgasmic experience. And the crowd thinks it's very funny. And so that movement with that white power kind of thing, it's just like the okay symbol. Which has become a symbol of white power. You go back to the history of that okay symbol. It began as a hoax. These sort of online right wingers sort of saying, let's get these liberals thinking that this is a white power symbol and they'll get so upset. The joke worked so well that it became real. And now it's a white power symbol. Same with that white power tweet. This is what Trump does. He says something vile, disgusting. I'm just joking, not joking. Joking, not joking. It's the back and forth, by the way. I mean, you reach back to your childhood years and you remember there were bullies that would do this, right? The way a bully says, I'm joking. They say something mean. Maybe I'm not joking. It's a way, it's an also authoritarian way of destabilizing reality. And it's entertaining for people who like it. So at Trump rallies, one joke that he likes to tell is that maybe he'll stay more than 4 more years. And right. He'll say it, and he says, no, I'm just joking to mess with the reporters back there, those scum and so on. He says, but maybe I will stay more. joking, not joking. It's a way of introducing and expanding the window. White power, joking. I didn't mean to say that, but maybe I did.
I mean, I also have to say that aside from the religiosity element that is coming through, it's Rush Limbaugh. I mean, Rush Limbaugh was the original progenitor of, you know, you're going to get Vince Fostered, the Hillary Clinton, they're murderers. Whenever he got called on anything, you know, he's not quite as relevant as he was, at least in the culture. Would say, I'm an entertainer. I'm joking. And then it would die down. And then he would say, but, you know, maybe I'm not. Trump is talk radio, but there has been, and I think you've captured this in this piece, there's something else that has been now projected onto him that he is absorbing and then and using. How much do you think it's just exclusively him, or are, like, do you have a sense of what figures around him? I mean, like, I keep thinking that Bannon is still heavily involved in at least this level of the communication, because that's so much of what of Breitbart, of Gamergate, of Pizzagate. I mean, it all came out of that sort of nexus and mentality.
I think what you say there is important, because I think what we have to look at here is, and as fascinating as I find Trump's sort of control of the audience and that dynamic between his audience and him, we always have to remember that the threat here is not Trump, it's Trumpism. It's a much broader movement. And that's the rhetorical mode of that movement, but he's not the only one who can do it. He's not the one who invented it. I don't know. I don't have any special information about Bannon secretly being involved. I don't think that would have to be the case, because these are the ideas that are in the air. And that movement between the kind of sort of seriousness and kind of violence, really genuinely fascistic rhetoric. And I don't use that term lightly. In fact, I've been arguing for years that American leftists, you know, stop declaring everybody fascist. Fascism is it's a thing with a history. There's more than one kind of bad under the sun. In fact, I even, in my book, The Family, I said, look, fascism is not going to happen in America for good reasons and bad, but it's not part of the American grain. I was wrong. This is it. You see someone, who's an influential character now. You see someone like Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller is, you see that influence all through his rallies. Another thing that goes on that's unreported, mostly unreported, partly because the political press is trying to cover these rallies as political events, and they're listening for the lines that are about traditional politics and policies. So then when Trump goes on for 20 minutes, as he did in Hershey, Pennsylvania, describing in slasher movie terms the violences that are allegedly being committed by illegals, as he put them, and animals, as he put them, who he claims that the Democratic Party is going through Democrat cities and releasing into the countryside. I mean, full on conspiracy theory, saying they go to their jails and they find rapists and they send them out in the countryside where they commit decapitations, disembowelments, beating people to death with baseball bats. If you paid attention to the Tulsa rally, you heard it. He talked about animals carving young women up. And it's always implicitly men of color attacking young women who are implicitly white. Sometimes he says blonde, beautiful young blonde woman, carving them up with a knife, going on in such detail for this. That's a lot of that is Stephen Miller. He's not writing that. Trump is ad-libbing that material. Well, some of that is Bannon. Some of that, though, is in some ways Trump just feeding off the crowd itself, which wants a titillating tale, which wants to feel angry, which wants to feel that its rage is justified. And if you say, oh my God, those animals are carving someone up with a knife to kill them more slowly. They eat hearts. This is something Trump claims, that they carve hearts out and eat them. If that's true, then all your anger, you can have an ecstasy of anger, and it's all justified. You don't have to hold back. And now you've got an electric current flowing between yourself and the power at the top.
Do you have any indication, or just maybe, you know, from your an academic perspective? I mean, I spent a little time reading about Melanistic cults in school, but that was many, many years ago, and just sort of the amazing durability of these things. You know, the world's going to end on June 25th, and it's June 26th, and it's like, oh, we got the numbers. We got confused because of the change in the calendar that happened, you know, 1,500 years ago. It's actually going to be August 23rd or something. You know, presuming like all the QAnon stuff doesn't happen. I mean, we keep waiting for them to reveal. And I thought Mueller was going to come out with indictments with Clinton based upon my QAnon-ness. But assuming that none of the QAnon stuff comes to fruition, is there, and let's just say that Donald Trump loses and eventually leaves the White House, knock on wood, do you have a sense of, from talking to people, either A, if there's an individual who could inherit this movement, or B, a sense of who that person might be? Like maybe the profile of that person?
I'll tell you, it's not Mike Pence, people like him. Trumpers like him just fine. They don't love him. Some people think that he's actually part of the swamp that Trump is going to drain. You know, there's this idea that all these Trumpers who he has disavowed, Jeff Sessions and Jim Mattis and Rex Tillerson and so on, all these figures, that was all part of this deliberate move that Trump brought those people into the administration so that he could expose them. And in that way, there is, as you say, this millenarian kind of end times theology, but it's endlessly adaptable. And if the prophecy doesn't happen, that's okay, because Trump is, as they say, he's a multi-layer chess player. He's moving on more layers than we can possibly know. There's more going on than you can possibly know. And I think that also leaves the door open, right? If Trump is to somehow leave the scene for someone else to emerge. In fact, what I think is important, and I think the left and liberals who aren't really paying attention to this as a social movement, so many people want to believe it's not real. You know, after I came back from these rallies in the fall, I did actually a sort of social media survey. I said, do you think, I was so stunned by what I'd seen, the scale, the organization. I said, do you think these rallies are, do you think they're A, astroturf, or do you think they're just, you know, maybe camera tricks, smoke and mirrors, or do you think they're real? It was just, you know, survey of acquaintances. I got about 1,000 responses. 75% said they're smoke and mirrors, right, or astroturf. And this is not the case. If these are actors, these are the best actors I've ever seen. Give them all an Oscar. This is big and this is real. And that makes it a social movement that can adapt itself. And I think what Trump is, people who see Trump as this is the worst, we've reached the low point in American history. I'm afraid not. If we're taking the F word seriously, if we're taking fascism seriously, Trump is a gateway. There could be certainly worse to come. And I think why we need to be organized, and here I'm being political, but is to remember that Trumpism extends far beyond this person. Maybe you do get Trump out of office at the end of this year. Maybe he actually leaves. Staying behind will be 200 judges. Staying behind will be all the generals that have been promoted, the Trump loyalist generals, all the people in all the agencies and departments, some political appointees, and they're off, but their resumes have been burnished. Some, the right kind of lifers who have been promoted, those who've been adapted themselves to Trump. If we understand it as a social movement with real religious undertones, we recognize that this is not just a personnel matter. This is a long-term struggle, I think, with a now an openly fascist tendency in the United States.
Jeff Charlotte, the piece is inside the cult of Trump. His rallies are church, and he is the gospel. We'll put a link to that piece at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.